Okay, I'm told the session has officially started, so we're going to play a video, so if you want to come closer to make sure you can see and hear all right, that would be great. Okay, so just to remind you, this session is on Leslie Norris among the Mormons. And presumably, you know who Leslie Norris was, but just to refresh everybody's memories, Leslie Norris was a poet in residence at BYU for many years, had a big influence on many student writers at BYU, and hence a big influence on a lot of Mormon literature. And this session is sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters, otherwise known as AML, and I am the AML representative here. My name is Lorraine Wilkins, and I wanted to mention just a couple of things. A plug for AML, first of all. We have a table in the other room where the books are, so you can check us out if you don't know very much about us. You can subscribe to Irriantum, which is our literary journal, of which I am the editor. Take a look at annuals, back issues, and find out more about what AML does. The other thing I wanted to mention is that this session on Leslie Norris is part of a larger project that the AML is taking on the subject of Leslie Norris among the Mormons. We are doing, our next issue of Irriantum will focus on poetry, and we will have a special section dedicated to the memory of Leslie Norris. We solicited some essays from people who knew Leslie and had something to say about him. And if you're interested in writing something, we'll still take things. Everything that we get will actually be published on a website. So this is the other part of the larger project commemorating Leslie Norris. The website is called A Motley Vision, and it's dedicated to promoting Mormon arts and letters. So everything that we get will actually be published on that blog site. Some of them will be published in Irriantum. So talk to me afterwards if you'd like to submit something you'd really like to hear from lots of people. So let's go ahead and get started. I wanted to, we're going to start with a video. This is an interview that was conducted in March of 2006. So it was just about a month, or maybe even just a few weeks before Leslie died, actually. Yeah. Leslie died unexpectedly on April 6th, which I think is a rather interesting date from a Mormon perspective. But the fact that Leslie felt so much at home among his colleagues and students at BYU seems to be kind of anomalous in a way, since we hear lots of stories about restrictions and difficulties at BYU sometimes. But Leslie seemed to be very much at home, and so I think that's a really worthy subject to take a look at and think about. This video, or this clip, or excerpt from the interview will give us a little bit of a sense of Leslie's personality. And I think what we selected, this interview was conducted by Guy Labita, who's here. He's one of our panelists. Why don't we go ahead and take a look at this, and then I'll introduce each of the panelists individually.
This snippet is about how we got to BYU.
Which you're getting was, I don't ever remember three pages of poems before or since in the Atlantic Monthly. And so, as a result of that, I was invited to go as the visiting poet to the University of Washington, as the Theodore Retke visiting poet. Retke, having died, they decided to leave his resident poet's position open to visiting poets a year or a semester at a time. And I went there four or five times, I think. During that time, I had a great student, Dennis Clark, who came from Orem. You might have known his father, Martin Clark, who was a professor in the English department. And Dennis was a wonderful student who had read everything, remembered everything, loved poetry, wrote it, and so he was also on the committee of a little body which held a writing course up at the Y in the summer term. It was called the Rocky Mountain Writers, something or other, Federation, I think. And so Dennis and Bruce Jorgensen, who taught at the Y and still does, invited me to go and read there. I'd never been to Utah, I'd never heard of Orem or Provo. And so I read and there and taught a little class there and also read both in Orem Library and Provo Library during the week I was there. And 2 years later, a member of the English department who was doing study abroad in London came down to my house in Sussex and asked if I would go to the Y as a visiting poet for 6 months. Kitty and I, during my reign as a travelling poet all over England, never refused any offer to visit and read, and we've never done it since. So we said yes, we would go. And we came out in February, January, and we'd had a little party in my house in Sussex the day before we left, and there were primroses in the garden, Christmas roses, early snowdrops, all kinds. We made little posies for the dining table, and it was a lovely day. We got here and it was bitterly cold. The snow was dirty. There wasn't a blade of grass to be seen. And Kitty leaned over to me in the car as we came down to Provo, and she said, "Can you make it 6 weeks?" But we couldn't. We stayed here ever since. Because eventually I used to come for the fall and winter terms and go back to England, which wasn't really economically sensible, really, because I didn't have medical benefits and things like that, you know. And so I accepted their offer to make me a full-time professor, and I've done that ever since. So that's how I came here.
Can I ask a question?
Than I have taught in any other university. It's markedly different because of Watkins' influence on Thomas.
There is a spot where he mentions at least one of our panelists as a Sterling former student.
And he talks about how wonderful it was to teach students at BYU.
And how
the
BYU students were the best he had anywhere.
So, okay. So very briefly, you can get more information about all of our panelists from the program, but very briefly, the people who are here are Guy Labida, who is head of the literary program with Utah Arts Council, and in that capacity, he got to know Leslie when he was an invited speaker, and they spent lots of hours driving through various parts of Utah, and got to know each other quite well and became very good friends. Jerry Johnston works for the Deseret News. He's the religion columnist and has done lots of other things for the Deseret News. And I don't know very much about the story of how you got to know Leslie, but maybe you can tell us. And then Lance Larson is a poet and one of among Leslie's first students, from what I understand, at BYU. And he's also a faculty member in the English department right now at BYU. So I guess we can go in the order that in which you are sitting and in which you've been introduced, if that's all right.
I wrote a little memoir, I guess you'd call it a little memory of Leslie, addressing the issue we're all here to talk about, Leslie Norris among the Mormons. Not being a Mormon myself, I think I was probably invited here to be the fly on the wall or the token Methodist, I guess. But it was a subject that we discussed from time to time, and Leslie and I discussed from time to time. So I wrote this little piece. I thought I'd just go ahead and read it to you. It has an epigram. That's a quote from Mark Twain that Leslie pointed me to
very early in our friendship because he thought I was dangerously irreverent for my Utah constituency, and he was trying to warn me. And the quote is this, it's from The Mysterious Stranger. Irreverence is a word to describe another person's disrespect to your God. There is no word to describe what your disrespect is to his God. Many years ago, before I met Leslie Norris, another well-known Utah poet, Dave Lee of St. George, told me all about him. He was a great admirer of Norris and his work, and said he couldn't for the life of him figure out how a poet like Leslie managed to survive and thrive in what Dave called an aggressively religious institution like BYU. It was particularly puzzling to Lee and to some others because Norris was never a member of the dominant religion in Utah. Dave said to me, he's their pet Gentile, and they treat him like their own national treasure. Other writers, and including me, puzzled over this many times about Leslie at BYU. And in fact, at the beginning of the relationship, Leslie, he doesn't mention it on this tape, on this interview, but he told me himself that he had doubts that he wanted to work at a religious institution. And it was only after representatives, the ones who asked him to come as the visiting writer, assured him that no one would ever try to convert him, that he agreed to this six-month appointment. He had to have that assurance in place first. As we all know, the temporary appointment resulted in a very good fit between Norris and the institution that lasted more than 20 years. And if he were here right now, he would chime in at this point to say, no one ever did try to convert him. They were as good as their word. It should be stated clearly right here that whatever initial misgivings Leslie and Kitty may have had about coming to the university, they loved BYU instantly, and they told me this many times, and both of them have told me many times that the students at the Y were the best they ever had. And this is high praise, considering that both of them taught at colleges and universities all over the U.S. and the U.K. And Leslie pointed to their students' eagerness to learn, exemplary work habits, respectful attitude toward their elders. And Kitty's quote was, they're just beautiful boys and girls. They're a joy to teach. Doesn't that sound like her? He genuinely liked and was liked by his colleagues at the university too, in the English department and elsewhere. And he felt real gratitude to the faculty and administration of BYU for the manner in which he was welcomed and supported throughout his whole stay at BYU, both as a professor of English and as a creative artist. It meant a lot to him to have that kind of institutional home. Another sort of man, I think, or another sort of poet might have felt he would have to either convert to the LDS faith or to leave the institution. But when we think about it, I think none of us who really knew Leslie should be surprised that he had any difficulty, that he had no difficulty fitting in without conforming to prevailing customs, because he was an anomaly everywhere he went. He didn't consider it to be a disadvantage that he wasn't part of the dominant religion at the religious school, because I'm convinced of this, that as a man and as an artist all his life, he was the exception to the rule. He didn't expect to find anybody like himself, because there wasn't anybody like him, and I think he knew it. He was an extraordinary man. As proof of this, I offer the fact that I rarely and maybe even never had an ordinary conversation with him. Every time we spoke at any length, I came away with something remarkable. My notebooks and diaries are filled with quotes and anecdotes, jokes, obscure facts from Norris, and he scattered these treasures liberally and graciously in his casual conversation. He was very learned, and he was never pedantic, at least not with me. And though I never had opportunity to have a class from him, I can say with confidence that he was one of the greatest teachers of my life. He also understood that he hadn't come to BYU in order to be just like everybody else. There was no shortage of Mormon professionals on the campus, I think, when he arrived. And so they hadn't hired him to be one of those guys. He knew it was his job to bring a special perspective, an enormous talent, and vast experience to the place and to the people. And for its part, I think the university understood that his uniqueness, his differences, made him very valuable to the institution. He offered something to his BYU students that they wouldn't get in courses taught by American or homegrown professors. And so in many ways, the fact that he wasn't Mormon, that he wasn't one of the Utah scene, was an advantage for all parties, and it was a thing to be celebrated and not corrected. In my conversations with him, I discovered pretty early that it was his habit to handle these kind of differences, particularly the religious differences, with humor. It was gentlemanly, always, because he was the most gentlemanly man I ever knew. But he found it very funny, actually, the differences in religions. And he was a deeply spiritual person himself, although I wouldn't describe him as religious. And I think he thought there were a lot of things about all religions that were pretty funny. And he made jokes, and I'm not sure how widely they were shared among his colleagues, but I'm going to tell on him now. Here's one. "I've had occasion to go to the wine store in Orem," he said. "And sometimes I run into my colleagues there from the Y. I always say to them, I won't say anything if you don't say anything. And they always say to me, deal." He had a variation on that joke. It was, he would go to the wine store and run into a colleague from the Y, and they always explained they were just picking up some cheap red wine for Coq au Vin. And he would say, he would pause a couple beats and he'd say, "I shouldn't think there would be a chicken left in all of Utah County." these jokes were just jokes. I mean, he never purported that he actually did see any of his colleagues in this way. But he was not disrespectful to his colleagues or to their faith. And by way of illustration, one of his favorite jokes was an anecdote that actually happened to him, and it's a joke he tells on the Catholics. He was watching a huge rugby match in Cardiff, Wales, with his good friend, the poet John Orman. And across the field from the grandstand was an abandoned brewery. And as the two teams left the field at the interval and everybody was standing to clap, a sudden and inexplicable puff of black smoke appeared from the brewery smokestack. "Look there, Norris," Orman said to him. "We've got a Welsh Pope." Leslie was realistic, I think, about his position in a predominantly LDS community. He understood that while his friends and colleagues respected his wishes concerning religion and especially concerning proselytizing during his sojourn among them, he harbored no doubts that his friends and colleagues believed that they knew what was best for him in the long run. And he accepted that. He told me once that the matter of his own baptism by proxy and thereby his own eternal salvation had long been a settled matter among his friends. He wouldn't say any more than that, but he said, "I know this is a settled matter." And I take that as, he took that as a sign of genuine affection. It was a signal of their determination to take care of him, whether he wanted them to or not, in the next world as well as in this world. Let's see, what else was I gonna say about him? Oh, well, Leslie and Kitty, it should be remembered, were foreigners in the country, not just in Utah County. And they never, it was easy to forget that they weren't Americans. And I remember once talking to them in the summer and forgetting about their origin. I said to them, "So what are your plans for the 4th of July?" And Leslie looked at me and he said, "Oh, we don't celebrate, we mourn." He never took any steps to become an American citizen, and he never took any steps in toward becoming a Mormon either. But this should in no way be interpreted as a lack of respect or affection on his part for his adopted home in Utah County. He never regretted his decision to stay in Utah. He felt the choice was a good one for himself as an artist and as a man. And in his later poem, one of his later poems, "The Visitation of Welshmen," he quotes the ghost of one of his Welsh ancestors, who visits him on the bank of the Provo River. "You've a good place here, right enough," Willie John says. That's his great uncle. "Tribal, Utes, Zunis, Mountain Men, Mormons, we Joneses would fit right in. That was his grandfather's surname, Jones. You've chosen well. So I think he did. I think he chose well, and it was a fortunate choice for him and for Kitty and for all of us, too. So that's it. That's what I have to say about Leslie among the more.
I'm pleased that people had come out and want to know a little bit more about Leslie among the Mormons. I want to touch a little on something that the guy said that, you know, when I, after 30 years at the Deseret News, I've learned a little truth about the state, and that's that many people think that being a person of distinction and a good member of the church must be the catbird seat in Utah, but it really isn't. After all these years in the newspaper game, I've kind of learned that being a person of distinction and a good friend of the Mormon Church is the best place to be. And if you look back at the careers of people like Eugene Jelesnik and Bud Kassler over at Mountain Fuel, George Niederauer, they were the golden people for the church. And Leslie kind of benefited from that. He was a person of distinction and a good friend of the church. I talked to Leslie about BYU several times. He used to love to talk about the boys' schools where he used to teach in England. I remember once he told me he got called into a headmaster's office where he'd been named poet in residence. And he said, the headmaster looked at him and said, "Mr. Norris," he said, "there's a lot of poetry being written at this school. I want you to put a stop to it." And I guess in some ways he felt that was his calling at BYU. But what he told me, he said that I fit in, he told me that he fit in really well at BYU because it reminded him so much of teaching in those British boys' schools. You know, there was the honor code, the dress code, behavior code, and of course, you know, sex was just totally verboten. And so he says that he kind of was able to kind of go with the flow. And it got me thinking a little bit that people like Leslie probably were able to relate to a kind of neo-Victorian attitude in Mormonism. You know, you think about Mormonism in Victorian England, and there's a lot of parallels, you know, not just that Mormons quote Kipling and Tennyson a lot, but, you know, the idea of the beautiful child and that the children are the jewels of existence and, you know, the sound mind and a sound body and the stiff upper lip. And then, of course, you have Baden-Powell and all his Victorian virtues in the Boy Scouts, which is, you know, a code for young men that's just basically a complete package of how to make a good Victorian. You know, trust, loyalty, cleanliness, friendliness, thriftiness, all those great Victorian virtues. And so I think people like Leslie and Arthur Henry King and other British people, they feel kind of at home in Utah because of those Victorian elements. And then, too, in talking with Leslie, I asked him about the class distinctions in Britain and how he functioned in America, where we're supposedly classless, or at least we say we have no classes, but, you know, we don't mention them. And he said that he said something very interesting to me. He says in Britain, he says, poets get a special dispensation. He says they're allowed everywhere, but they belong nowhere. And he said he was always able to move up and down the class system in Britain. He could go into a cocktail party at the House of Lords and then in 20 minutes later be talking to the chauffeur in the garage. And nobody would think any different of it. He was just a poet, and that's what poets did, as they floated. And poets were at home everywhere and at home nowhere. And it kind of got me thinking, it was probably how Shakespeare could write in Hamlet so well about life in the court and the royal family and yet get the gravedigger and the other people so right as he floated back and forth among all the classes. And so the second reason I think Leslie fit in is he fit in everywhere and he fit in nowhere. And Utah was just another place that kind of felt like that to him. He had a lightness about the church. He never took it too seriously. He never felt threatened by it. And I think some of Guy's jokes and comments, he told me once he was walking across campus and he saw Gene England and he stopped Eugene England. And he said, "Gene," he says, "I was reading about those golden plates." And he said, "by the size that they were described," he says, "Gene, those plates must have weighed so much a man could barely heft them off the ground." And Gene said, "Ah, Leslie, the men of God are remarkable men, aren't they?" And he laughed at that. He never took anything too seriously, and I think that was the, that he was able to kind of float and move on the, you know, without sinking in everything. But I think Guy also hit on the real reason why Leslie fit in so well with the Mormons, and that's because even though I don't know what vocabulary he'd used to talk about it, his poetry reveals him as a deeply spiritual person. I don't think, at least from the way I define terms and ideas, I don't think anyone could have put the compassion into a poem like Danny Rose, the boxer that lost his sight, or Hudson's Geese, you know, the mother goose and the father goose, as they, one's walking and one's flying south. I don't. I think that's a spiritual quality, that level of compassion. And I think Leslie was probably the finest elegist of his generation. And I think the reason is he would not only take an elegy and fill it with humanity, but there'd be a transcendent quality to that elegy. There's something that pointed beyond, something deeper and broader and richer and warmer than the human existence. And so I think Leslie was, I think he would probably have called himself a Protestant. You know, you'd have to ask Kitty how he would define himself. I don't know, maybe he wouldn't. But I think that deep spiritual nature, and I think he was able to draw that out of his students. And I think he was able to, his students were able to relate to him because of that. I can't see a BYU student reading Hudson's Geese and not feeling deeply moved in a spiritual way about that poem. So I guess that's why, when I think about Leslie among the Mormons, other people would have more inside information and maybe more access to the workings of his heart. But in the little anecdotal moments I spent with him, I would say those are the four things that came to mind to me, that he fit in because he recognized in Mormonism his old English roots. You know, we have to remember that when Gordon B. Hinckley was a missionary in England, that Queen Victoria's corpse was still warm over there. That was, you know, a long time ago. And I think the fact that he was so used to floating from class to class and culture to culture, and Utah was as good a place as any to call home because every place was home. And I think that's one reason he fit in. And the fact he never let it get him down or let him bogged him down. He used his humor to kind of elevate him. But I think the real reason Leslie stayed and hung with the Mormons is because I think he felt the spirituality beneath it, the Elan. It's when people write about BYU and they write about the Mormon Church, it's the one thing that a lot of writers outside of Utah never quite get. They never quite get the life force, you know, to borrow from Shaw, that pushes it. They look at the social elements of it, you know, while they, people stay in the church because they like being told what to do, or people stay in the church because it's a good community for having funerals and weddings and business pressures and social pressures. But it's the life force. It's Shaw's life force that pushes people through. And I think Leslie felt that same life force, and he related to it in Utah. He was a remarkable man. I do agree that BYU put him on a pedestal, but they could never build a pedestal high enough for him. Anything they did for him, any honorary degree, any stipend, any 6 months in England or whatever they gave him, would have not been enough. He single-handedly, I think, brought an international light onto BYU and the English department down there. And there's a lot of great writers down there, but Leslie was a real jewel. And it'll be interesting to see if BYU can get its antenna out and find anybody that's anywhere near his caliber to replace him.
I'm probably a little off topic here. This is more of a tribute that I want to give. And it's really a piece that I wrote in response to Lorraine's invitation. It's a collage, I guess, in prose, but I end up quoting pieces of poems that Leslie has written. And so what I'll try to do is just pause before I read sections of the poem. I thought of doing it in voice, but when I try to do a Welsh or British accent, it comes out sounding like Monty Python cross-dressing of some sort. So I won't attempt that. But the title of this is called Walking the White Fields. Behind his eyes lie the slim silver boys called by my name. He was a Welshman, this Leslie Norris, who came to the Rocky Mountains by way of Seattle. A two-semester stint that turned into nearly 25 years, and we, lucky novice poets, fell under his sway. Who was he? Epithets fail, but fail beautifully. So let us begin there. Singer of stones, pilot, gardener, bicyclist of the clouds, soccer maven, translator, only sometimes of words, CEO of the seasons, cataloger of grasses, late romantic, medium, raconteur, pantheist, scop, bald angel, publicist of hummingbird and hawk, amateur pugilist, pacifist, fisherman, walker of white fields, Isaiah of the senses, critic, breeder of lovebirds, lover, dog whisperer, keeper of earth, wind, water, and fire. The poem stands on its firm legs. Now I am cleaning the teeth in its lion jaws with an old brush. I'll set it wild on the running street, aimed at the hamstring, the soft throat. A poet who taught and teaching helped others to see, that was Leslie. I can conjure the lessons in craft we scribbled in our notebooks, and we hoped, on some permanent wall of our psyches. Quote, after finishing your masterpiece, cut the first five lines and the last. No adverbs. Worry about verbs first, then nouns. Use adjectives only if they remake the noun. Never a large elephant, but maybe, just maybe, a tiny elephant or a scholar elephant. Then there was the more general advice, also important. Write for the little old man in Chicago who hasn't gone to college. Other lessons remain harder to sum up. Once, visiting him in his office, away from the hurly-burly of the classroom, I asked, what else can I do to become a writer? I was trying to get the edge up on all my classmates. Tense and eager, I waited. What piece of wisdom would multiply my modest gifts like the miracle of the loaves? He looked out his window at craggy, snow-covered Mount Timpanogos. Take a walk. Sit down. Be alone in the natural world. I didn't like that advice. Part of me wanted to dismiss this as so much Wordsworthian romanticism. Fine for a Welshman, but not for me. And yet, something underneath rang true. He was trying to explain that beneath or inside the words of any decent poem lay an essential confluence of solitude, perspective, vision. In short, a lived life, self-knowledge. We must all become poets, he sometimes said, whether or not we ever write a decent poem. A full voice sang of such inhuman longing that I no more can say which was the song or which the fiery star. The girl I loved from upstate New York by way of Peru, hailed from upstate New York by way of Peru, and I from Idaho by way of Colorado, both of us strangers to Utah, without a place to receive friends hoping to wish us joy or at least good luck upon marrying. Wishes we needed badly, since Jackie painted and I wrote poems and neither of us had any promise of giving up and turning practical. So I asked Leslie one afternoon, may I borrow your house? He did not shrug his shoulders or look at his fingernails or explain that his current abode was not well suited for crowds, but said, of course. So on the appointed evening, my two siblings sistered the refreshment table. Gifts arrived and well-wishers shook our hands. And none of us knew that Leslie and Kitty had squirreled away an entire year's worth of cookies in case we ran out of the refreshments we had brought. Outside, the sprinklers, waving their spraying rainbows, kept America green. In all, I took three classes from Leslie. Later, after completing a PhD, I returned to become a colleague, well, sort of. More opportunities to bathe in his stories. I loved the way he told them, parceling them out like gumdrops. Stories about Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath, stories about pubbing with Dylan Thomas, about cleaning up John Masefield's terrible nosebleed minutes before Masefield received a prestigious international award, his white shirt pink and wet, but otherwise none the worse for wear. Whenever I suggested that Leslie should write up his anecdotes in a literary memoir, he laughed and shrugged it off. He was loath to attach himself to the famous. But catch him at the right moment, and his telling of a story resulted in a kind of oral publication, or shall we call it transubstantiation, the stories taking on a new life inside us. Story, anecdote, tale, he told them all with relish. He had a comic's timing and confidence, an ironist sense of fruitful juxtaposition. Some of you will remember the story he told, went something like this, about a handbill for an upcoming medical lecture. Unusual obstetric occurrences. Solemn enough title. That is, until some wag scribbled beneath it, "Mary had a little lamb." Just as the laughter subsided, Leslie would smile again and say, "Quite true. Holy Mary, poor girl, she did have a little lamb." A bridge launched, hovering, wondering where to land. A bridge is the path of flight. Early Thursday morning, April 6, Leslie suffered a massive stroke, which left him unconscious. I learned of his stroke minutes after my 8 o'clock class ended. What I had feared for years had finally taken place. I hurried to the hospital to keep vigil with friends and neighbors and writers and with dear Kitty, who sat beside him holding his hand. It was a strange and harrowing time. We knew Leslie would not wake or recover, but we behaved like children, believing ourselves safe from the full impact of loss, as long as our friend kept breathing. And breathe he did. Loud, open mouth, laboring breaths, very close to snores. One friend brought flowers, another specialty soups, the rest of us goodwill. One offered to make a pine casket. A fellow Welshman who had driven down from Salt Lake said, "Anyone have palms?" I dug into my backpack and handed him a collection by Czesław Miłosz, the Polish Nobel Prize winner, which Leslie's friend read to Leslie. Next came my turn. I pulled out a collection of essays and read a short piece called "I Believe" by Catholic writer Brian Doyle. Holding Leslie's hand, I relearned what he had taught me so many years before, that symbolic black marks arranged on a page sometimes equal deep mystery. How else explain their ability to concentrate the mind, quicken the senses, and collect inchoate feelings like a lightning rod? A sample then of what I read, quote, "I believe that the fingerprints of the Maker are everywhere, children, hawks, water. I believe that even sadness and tragedy and evil are part of that mind we cannot comprehend, but only thank. A mind especially to be thanked, oddly, when it is most inscrutable. I believe that everything is a prayer. I believe additionally that friends are family. I believe that the best of all possible breakfasts is a pair with a cup of ferocious coffee taken near the ocean, rather later in the morning than earlier, preferably in the company of a small, sleepy child, still in her or his rumpled and warm pajamas, his or her skin as warm and tawny as a cougar pelt. I believe that love is our greatest and hardest work. Amen." Could Leslie hear me as I read to him? I don't know. I also don't know how many times I had to stop mid-sentence to collect myself. Here I was, a Mormon reading the words of a Catholic to a dying friend who confessed no religion, but embodied wholeness and uncommon spirituality. God had rarely leaned closer. 4 hours later, when it came time to say my final goodbye, I hugged Leslie, kissed his cheek and forehead, and inhaled, an indulgence I wasn't about to pass up. A cool, moist washness filled my head. Though he wore nothing but a hospital gown, I could smell his accent in poems, his debonair woolens, and his chatty anecdotes about Dylan Thomas, and a raininess that fell that day and for weeks to come. I lace heavy boots, break brittle ice, feel winter's bones under the snow. I hold my skull to the wind. Less than 2 weeks after Leslie's passing, I happened upon one of my journal entries dated December 1997. It came as a shock, as if someone else had written it. Quote, "In my dream, we were fishing, Leslie Norris and I. Late afternoon, mid-December, but temperate. No snow, more like September, and the day about that long. We were making our way up the canyon, crossing, then recrossing the river. Provo River, maybe, though not that wide. Did we actually cast? I don't think so, though we had our poles out, flies ready. I was supposed to be acting as guide. Then we gave up and walked toward a cabin near the river, or a community lodge. A man and his young son were eating pancakes. So we joined them. All this done wordlessly, though Leslie acted as negotiator. There were plenty of pancakes. And we kept drenching the pancakes with syrup, then eating. Behind us, a hearth and fireplace of stone. Ah, Leslie, even in my dream, I seem to have gotten you right. A friend with whom to journey, a crosser of rivers, the welcomer welcomed by strangers. Then the eating of a meal. How we hungered. How those pancakes steamed. The small summer hangs its suns on the chestnuts, and the world bends slowly out of the year."
Thanks so much to all of you. I'm really touched. We have about 15 minutes for discussion, questions, comments. You have, yeah, please.
I met Leslie later on in his career, but I'd like to know what this transition from his home country to Utah did to his own creative voice. Did he write more or less when he was settled here? Did it change? Did he go more to prose than poetry? What did it do to him to make this transition to Utah?
I can attempt an answer. One thing you need to know about Leslie is that he considered poetry...
A gift. Poet as prophet, a modest prophet perhaps, but... poet as prophet. He waited for poems. He wrote prose, but he felt he could do that in his sleep at any time. I mean, he, toward the end of his life, he didn't write that many pieces in prose. So he waited for poems. He continued to write about whales and his early experience, but he also wrote very persuasively about the desert. He has a wonderful poem, I think it's called Peaches, about... about gardening in the desert. He has a sequence of poems about the desert. So I think he continued to write about what was important to him, but he also saw how landscape would change him. And so I very much admired that. I don't know if he wrote more or less. Again, he waited for poems, and when they came, they came.
I think he wrote more convincingly about his childhood and about whales from Utah. I think he was like a lot of writers, that he needed that distance, because when you're in the mix and this, and you know, when you're stirred up in it, you can't let it find its level and find the mythological things in it. I think when he wrote about old men and whales and horses and whales and his stories about whales, I think they were probably richer because he got some distance. I think like a lot of expatriate writers, you know, from James Joyce to others, getting away from their homeland makes them write more convincingly about their homeland. I think Leslie did that. But he did have a wonderful eye, and he wrote some great poems about Utah that I think will always be with us about the state. I think moving to Utah made him a better writer and a better poet than if he would have stayed in Wales, is my own feeling.
I agree with what these guys have said, but I would just add one thing. I think he was sort of energized on a certain level when he came here because, in fact, it even occurs somewhere in the poems. He had some frustration. His work is so grounded in the natural world that when he started writing from here, he realized he didn't know the names of the birds or the trees. It didn't come as naturally to him. So I think he was in some ways intellectually sort of challenged to re-educate himself about the natural world. And that brought him back to his boyhood when he was learning the names of the trees and of the birds and of the plants that he saw around him. And I think that's when he really got back in touch with his boyhood. And a lot of poems that he wrote when he got here are placed in that sort of pre-literate time in his life. So I think while it was frustrating to him on a day-to-day basis, I think it was good for him as an artist to come here and not know what kind of tree that was, when it was the most natural thing. It was like breathing to him in England, in Wales.
Other questions?
I was thinking today of something he told me. He said, it's hard work. He told me once, he said, Guy, a thing that most poets don't realize is that it's hard work to be in the audience. It's hard work to listen to poems. And he said, it's very natural to see people look at their watch while you're giving them a reading. But if they hold it to their ear to see if it stopped, you've gone awry.
I wonder if you could say something about Leslie's influence on Mormon literature, just because he was a teacher of so many very fine, productive contemporary writers now, especially poets. And Les Larson, of course, is an example of that.
BYU needed a poet like him, though they didn't know it at the time. The poets in the department who wrote, some of them with decent gifts, wrote for a parochial audience. They wrote for other people in the valley. What Leslie brought was, even though his poems look back, even though they're agrarian, they brought an international understanding of poetry, and that you write for this larger audience. And he taught that indirectly, simply because he was publishing in the New Yorker all the time. But I think that filtered into the classroom. There wasn't this anxiety that you have to speak for the Mormon church or the Mormon culture, or that every poem has to have a scriptural epigraph of some sort. So I think in certain ways, he made students less anxious, just write. And he could help students concentrate on the most basic levels of lessons of writing. And if they did that, they would find their own material. And I think before that, in my limited experience, I arrived about the same time that he did to the university and took my first class about a year after he'd arrived. But I took some classes from other professors, and I just saw the contrast. He just showed them how to write about whatever their topic was.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think Dennis would probably be the one to address this more than anybody, but I think what Leslie gave a lot of his students was the ability to find their voice. You know, there's a line on the back of one of Leslie's books. It's a quote from James Dickey. And James Dickey says, most poets would kill to have Leslie Norris's authenticity of voice. He knew his voice, and he knew how to draw that voice out of other poets. And a lot of poets, like Lance was saying, were writing rhetorically, you know, trying to be impressive, and they were influenced by Hopkins and influenced by Thomas. And they weren't getting by these influences because they couldn't find their own voice, their own song. And I think Leslie's genius was he could recognize that in himself and recognize it in others and draw it out. And I think the BYU writers benefited more than, and this is a bias on my part, more than the University of Utah writers did under Mark Strand, because Leslie could hear better than Mark Strand could hear, and he could know what he was looking for in the poetry. Dennis is laughing. I don't know if that's true, but Do you want to come up and say something, Dennis? You're the guy that ought to be talking to this stuff.
I would say that I'm not sure if Mark Strand can hear it all.
One way that Leslie accomplished that was by cutting. He was a master editor. He knew what to take out of a poem. And that was extremely valuable. I went off to a PhD program wondering if I was prepared, and I was more than prepared. And that was the case with other poets who had studied with him, because they had learned what to take out of a poem, what not to say. And that's the hardest, one of the hardest lessons.
He learned the thing about authenticity of voice very early. In this interview, which eventually will stream as video from the Arts Council's website, he talks about he's 15 years old and pedals his bicycle to where? To a bookshop, above which a handful of young men poets meet and read each other's work. And he meets Vernon Watkins. And Watkins astonishes him, because when Leslie shows him the poems, he tells him exactly who he's been reading. He holds up one poem and says, oh, I see you've been reading so-and-so. And he was dead on. So Leslie figured out that not only did he have to find his own voice, but he learned this sort of detector of influences. And I think Jerry's absolutely right. And I think James Dickey was right, that most poets, writers of any kind, would give up a significant body part to have that kind of authenticity of voice.
Just one other comment about the kind of ties in with this idea of, you know, authenticity. And what Les was saying is having a poet at BYU who would let the students not have this burden of having to, you know, speak for the whole culture, the whole church. I've been struck in getting a lot of these submissions that we asked for essays about Leslie among the Mormons. A lot of them are more tributes than anything about Leslie or about Mormonism. And it struck me that there is really, I mean, it just didn't matter. It wasn't an issue. It wasn't something that came up. It's just, you know, a very authentic person, very authentic relationships, very, authentic experiences that came out with Leslie, and being Mormon was not even an issue. It just wasn't part of the equation, it seems.
I think you've hit it right on the head. I think just as Leslie could find an authenticity of voice, he could find an authenticity of relationship. And so he could have, you know, good LDS friends, and he could have wayward LDS friends, and he could have crazy people as friends, because he would find a way to find their center and relate to that. Leslie knew me through three stages of my life. I was LDS, and then I left the church, and I came back, and my relationship with Leslie never changed. Just I changed around him. And he was always able to relate to me on a very personal level. And so I think you probably hit on something. He didn't see the trappings. He saw the core, and he was able to find that in his own poetry and in his relationships. And I think it's one reason why people were so drawn to him, because they knew he wasn't going to give them a song and dance, and he wasn't going to fake it. If when you talk to Leslie, you got the real deal. And that's why people loved him so much, I think.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, issues you want to raise? Well, again, I hope that any of you who knew Leslie will be interested in writing something up about him, even if it doesn't address the topic of, you know, Mormonism in any specific way. We'd love to have as many tributes about Leslie as possible that we can make available. So thank you for coming, and thanks to our panelists for coming too.